It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferris.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll talk with WPR Steve Paulson about some books you might want to read, and we'll get your suggestions, too.
Right now, we're continuing our discussion about the future of healthcare in Wisconsin with Ed Miller, professor of political science at UW-Stevens Point. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. We'll go right to your calls now. We have Catherine with us in Appleton. Catherine, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. My name is Catherine, and I am the Regional Enrollment Network Coordinator for Partnership Community Health Center in Appleton. And, you know, Partnership is really on the forefront in the Tri-County area of getting out correct information to the community, in which, you know, the past 2 weeks we've had partnered up with United Way, and we've offered informational sessions when, you know, people can come in. We really give them the nuts and bolts of what they need to know about the law so that they can share this correct information. Specifically, a week ago Sunday, the Post Crescent ran a very large article about unwrapping Obamacare, and we were able to go through and, you know, highlight four different aspects of this article on the front page that were not correct. An AP article that ran today in the Oshkosh Northwestern, incorrect information. You know, so it's too bad that, you know, to get the story out, you know, incorrect information is being printed, but then, you know, it's coming back at us where, you know, where we're trying to ease the anxiety of what's to come, but it's so hard when not everyone is on the same playing field.
Gotcha. Thanks for the call, Catherine. Well, Ed, I mean, there's a lot of information out there. It's a fairly big, complicated program. Are you surprised that some bad info might be getting out there?
Right. Well, I'm not surprised, but there's a lot of it, and some of it is just misunderstanding. For example, a pharmacist told somebody yesterday that there would be no more flexible savings accounts, you know, where people put money in the flex account and then use it to pay part of their prescriptions, that was gone because of the Affordable Care Act. And, of course, that's not true. But there's a whole, Catherine was talking about this whole process of trying to get people signed up for this who qualify for the marketplaces, these exchanges, while there's a whole campaign going to take place on the opposite side of trying to tell people not to sign up for it. So this totally confuses individuals.
Thanks a lot for the call, Catherine. I'm going now to Guy in West Allis. Guy, hi.
Hi. My question mainly is, I understand in Wisconsin the 100% of poverty you have to go onto the exchanges, but at what point do you end up paying a percentage out of pocket? Is it 100% of poverty plus 10%, or is it like, you know, $20,000 and then you start kicking in 10% for every $10,000? At what point do you pay out of pocket? Because I think a lot of people are concerned of how expensive it's going to be, which is very true, but if they realize that if they make $20,000 and they only have to pay 10% towards their premium, they may not be so scared about it.
Gotcha, Guy. Thanks. I don't know if you have all those precise numbers.
That's a very, very good point. You would not pay a lot of it out of pocket because there's subsidies, and the subsidies go up to 400%. Of a federal poverty line. And for a family of four, that the subsidies end at about $92,000 family income. And so there's a substantial amount of subsidies. The easiest way to figure out your subsidies, there's a number of them out there. The Kaiser Family Foundation has one. They have calculators. And what you do is you put in your circumstances, your income, and a couple other variables it asked you, and it will give you an estimate of what your cost will be.
Guy, thanks a lot for the question. We'll go now to Carl in Madison. Hi, Carl.
Yes, hello. The New York Times just recently ran an article on the difference between how Minnesota is responding to both the federal health care initiative and also other issues that involve the poor, and comparing it to Wisconsin. And in one state, you've got to move toward the common good and making sure that everybody has the resources in place for a healthy community, unfortunately that being Minnesota. And then you've got Wisconsin, where Governor Walker talks about prudence, but it's kind of a shell game. He's really just throwing people out on the invisible hand of the market, which is either going to be in your back pocket or around your throat. And I'd love the guest's perspective either on our comparison with Minnesota or, if he's not particularly familiar with them, with any states that are not leaving money on the table, denying their own citizens access to coverage, versus an approach that's much more humanitarian and forward-thinking. Thank you.
Well, I mean, whether it's Minnesota or the other states, the other states are taking federal money, and even some states that are headed by some conservative governors have realized the importance of this money to the state and to their citizens. This is costing. This will cost the state a lot of money. You think you're cutting back, but in fact, this is going to cost the state. One example would be that in hospitals who see a lot of poor people, those hospitals get an extra payment from the federal government called disproportionate share. And with the individual mandate and the exchanges, disproportionate share is reduced from the federal government. So hospitals in Wisconsin were complaining about this, and given the fact that we're not taking the 133% of the poverty line in particular, whether and it doesn't matter whether we run exchanges or not, but we're not taking that 133%. So what the state is doing is they are making up some of that money through state money. So it's not only the federal grants that we're not going to receive for the individuals, but also the fact is that the state is putting out this money to hospitals when otherwise they wouldn't have had to do that.
Ed, I wanted to take the long view here. Earlier in the discussion, you mentioned a comparison with Social Security and Medicare. How does the Affordable Care Act compare to those programs in terms of the scope and how big a deal they are?
Well, the Affordable Care Act is possibly larger. It depends how you consider it, because in effect, the Affordable Care Act affects everyone really under 65. Although it did affect people in Medicare by giving them more benefits, but it's primarily for those under 65. While both Medicare, this is the Affordable Care Act, both Medicare and Social Security was only people over 65. So that is one way of looking at the difference. So it is broader in that way. However, it could also be more narrow because lots of people, the preponderance of people in America receive their health care coverage from their employer. And those employer policies will be minimally changed. So it really affects the smaller number of people. In that regard. So you have to look at who's affected, you know, who's technically under it is really larger, but on the other hand, the changes are really smaller.
And then comparing the political battle over them. Right now, I think we probably take Social Security and Medicare for granted. Did we see this kind of ongoing, years-long political battle over them, too?
Unbelievable. There was a tremendous fight about those as well. You go back to Social Security, people never forgave Franklin Roosevelt for Social Security. And in Medicare, there was a lot of opposition to Medicare. Medicare had been proposed going back to the 1930s. And so Medicare, and one of the reasons that Dingell, Congressman Dingell from Michigan, gaveled this in on the House floor, and he's now the senior member of the House, the fact is that his father had introduced a Medicare bill every single year, and then he had introduced one every single year. So when the Affordable Care Act was finally up for discussion at the time, he was given the gavel to gavel it in. So there was tremendous opposition. The American Medical Association opposed both Social Security and Medicare.
Ed, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
That was Ed Miller, professor of political science at UW-Stevens Point.
Coming up next, Wisconsin Public Radio's own Steve Paulson is here to share some great reading suggestions with us. And we'd love to hear your recommendations as well. You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
All right, behind the scenes, around the offices of Wisconsin Public Radio, it's hard to find anyone with more books going at once than the executive producer up to the best of our knowledge.
Steve Paulson joins us now in studio to share some of the most interesting new books that have crossed his desk lately. Steve, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Well, we met earlier in my office about this because your office was so overflowing with books there was nowhere to sit.
It's a little embarrassing, I have to say.
Embarrassment of riches. But that's exactly why you're here, because you see so many books and you read so many books per day. And you picked out a few of them to tell us, give us some recommendations. What
okay.
have you got?
Well, I'm going to start with a novel, which is really terrific. It's by Karen Joy Fowler called We Are All Completely Beside Ourselves. And it's a story of, I guess you would describe it as a chimpanzee is raised as part of a human family and the fallout that ensues. And just to put this in perspective, one thing that's really interesting is there's this flurry of novels that are coming out with chimps as characters. And it's like it's sort of this thing in the zeitgeist right now, which
is
kind of fascinating.
How does she handle a chimp as a character?
Well, she does it in a really interesting way. You don't know that a chimp is part of the story until about a third of the way in. So you hit about page 90, and she sets it up as there are these two sisters, twins, basically, raised together, and you only find out much later on that, oh, one of them's a chimpanzee.
Which is a spoiler alert, and we talked about this, but it is in the beginning third of the book, and you can't really talk about the book without it sounds like.
No, you can't. And this is actually based on a real-life example. Back in the 1930s, there was a scientist at Indiana University who wanted to see what would happen if you raised a chimpanzee as a human child. And actually, he did it in such a way that he brought in a chimp and raised it with his own son, and they were the same age, and they were growing up together, and all kinds of chaos ensued. And so Karen Joy Fowler has taken the same premise, basically, updated a little bit. It's set in the 1970s, and so it's wonderful because there's tragedy that ensues, so it's heartbreaking, but it's a wonderful story. And so the narrator of this is the girl who kind of has grown up, and she's reflecting back on what happened when she was 5 years old when this chimp was suddenly removed. Her sister was removed, and if you'd like, I could read you a very short passage.
Yeah, please.
Okay, so this is Rosemary is reflecting back on what it was like to grow up. She says, I always used to believe I knew what Fern was thinking. No matter how bizarre her behavior, no matter how much she might deck herself out and bob about the house like a Macy's parade balloon, I could be counted on to render it into plain English. Fern wants to go outside. Fern wants to watch Sesame Street. Fern thinks you are a doo-doo head. Some of this was convenient projection, but you'll never convince me of the rest. Why wouldn't I have understood her? No one knew Fern better than I. I knew every twitch. I was attuned to her.
Oh, that sounds really intriguing.
It's very intriguing. And part of the premise of this is it has to do with the way we have studied primates, the way scientists have studied primates. So, you know, there's always this question of how smart are primates? Our chimps are our closest relatives in the animal world. And so we try to get them to use sign language, basically to sort of take on the trappings of human communication. And so the premise here is, well, what if we tried to understand chimps more on their own terms? And what if a young human child communicated with a chimp basically nonverbally? You know, what happens when they're 3, 4, or 5 years old? That's sort of the premise here. And it's quite fascinating.
So much more interesting because it's based on a true story, too.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay, well, thanks for that one. And what do you got next?
Okay, actually, I have another book about animals, but this is nonfiction. It's by a philosopher named Mark Rowlands called Running with the Pack: Thoughts from the Road on Meaning and Mortality. And it's basically a sequel to an earlier book he wrote called The Philosopher and the Wolf. And there's a great story here. So Mark Rowlands is a British philosopher who moved to the U.S. In his 20s and got a job teaching at the University of Alabama. And right around the same time as he started this job, he adopted a young wolf, which you might not think is the smartest thing to do. So he takes the wolf home, and he realizes instantly, in the first 3 minutes, the wolf is in this living room. The wolf destroys the living room. And he realizes he can never leave the wolf alone. He's got to take the wolf, this wolf named Brennan, everywhere. So he takes him to class, takes him to his lectures. He has to, pretty soon, the wolf starts wandering up and down the lecture hall, poking its snout into the backpacks of the students, pulling out lunches. So he has to sort of put up a notice saying, secure your meals in your lunches. He, Mark Rowlands, is on a rugby team, and he takes the wolf, Brennan, to his rugby matches. They go on the road for hundreds of miles. They go out partying in bars afterwards. Brennan goes with them. He takes Brennan the wolf on all of his dates. He moves to other countries and takes Brennan. I mean, Brennan is his most important companion in his life.
I'm thinking some, you know, health codes were violated along the way there. But again, this is a true story, though.
This is a true story. So this is all nonfiction. And so he's written the sequel, which is about running. And, you know, Mark Rowlands is a philosopher. So he's citing Aristotle and Spinoza and all of these great philosophers. And he's reflecting on the meaning of running. And at one point he says, well, I like to run with wolves and with dogs rather than people because I want to think. I don't want to talk. He says thought is antithetical to talking. And again, if I can read a short passage from this, he says, running is a place where I remember. Most importantly, it is a place where I remember not the thoughts of others, but something that I once knew a lifetime ago, but was forced to forget in the process of growing up and becoming someone. I knew this, although I did not know that I knew it. And in this, I was just like everyone else. Running is a place for remembering. It is in this place that we find the meaning of running.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And so it's a meditation on running, and he just turns 50 at the time of this, and so it's his body starting to break down. So it's sort of also reflections on mortality and how you construct meaning in your life.
Now, have you interviewed that guy?
I did.
Did he bring the wolf?
The wolf actually has since died.
Oh,
so no.
That must have been devastating. No. That'll be the next book.
Yeah, no, actually, and it's a heartbreaking story because, I mean, the end of the story of Brennan the Wolf is Wolf dies of cancer. And so the last few months of his life, I mean, Mark Rowlands basically dedicates his own life to taking care of it, sort of trying to give the wolf a good death.
Oh, wow. Wow, that's fascinating. So a couple good books there if you want to read the one that came first. And this one is called Running with the Pack.
Right.
And you've got one more. We're turning back to fiction again. Mm-hmm. And this is one that has gotten a bit of buzz. And you recently interviewed the author. This is How You Lose Her.
This is How You Lose Her by Juno Diaz, who won a Pulitzer Prize for his last book, which is called The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde. And there's a lot of buzz about Juno Diaz. As you've said, he's a dazzling writer, and he has a totally distinctive voice. I mean, he just sounds like no one else. And Juno Diaz's own story is born in the Dominican Republic, moved to New Jersey when he was a kid, grew up there in a Dominican community, and that's very much the setting of his stories in this book. And so the narrator of all of these stories is named Junior, and it's kind of a fictional alter ego of Juno Diaz. And the story basically is there's sort of this tension between do you stay true to your ethnic roots? I mean, do you stay within that community or do you leave? Do you assimilate? And so Juno Diaz himself was this bookish, geekish kid, loved science fiction, was drawn to high culture, but also was very street smart, hung out with the other kids in the neighborhood. And part of the point of this is he's saying that there are traditionally sort of immigrant stories are, you know, either you assimilate or you sort of, you know, stay with the group that you stayed up with. He said, no, you can do both those simultaneously. And it's that tension that he's sort of playing out there. And the way he writes these stories is, you know, he mixes Spanish in with English. So sort of this Spanglish feel to it. It's very racy. I mean, I would read a passage from this, but I'm not sure if I could read one that would work on the radio here.
Oh, that's probably for the best then that we not read that one. So these stories, as I understand it, are they sort of beaded along? One sort of builds upon the other?
They are, yeah. So they're snapshots of different points in the life of this character, Junior. And he loves women, but he messes up every relationship he has with women. He always cheats on them, and he loves them. And so it's sort of this you're revisiting his life sort of every few steps along the way, sort of years later, and he's learned a little something later on, and finally by the end he sort of realizes he's kind of coming to some sense of revelation about himself. And this is, incidentally, this character Junior is a recurring character in some of Juno Diaz's books. So I think it's the third book that he's figured in, and so we will probably see more of him later. So it's sort of like it's probably one of these characters that we will see over the course of a decade or more.
Like
so.
John Updike Rabbit,
kind of thing.
Exactly. It's going to come back again and again.
Yes.
So you brought in three books, but I've seen the amount of books in your office. How do you keep them all in your head? I mean, do you read them all at once?
No, well, these I had the good fortune of actually interviewing all the authors, so that is a good excuse for me to dig into them. And but it's I feel lucky. I mean, I get a chance to read lots of great books. Occasionally, I get to talk to the authors as well, and so it's doesn't get any better than that.
All right. Well, we are so grateful for the recommendations. Thank you for coming in and sharing today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Steve Paulson is the executive producer of To the Best of Our Knowledge here at Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up, in light of President Obama's talk at the United Nations today, our guest says the age of American intervention needs to come to an end. Stick around. You're listening to Central Time here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about a public health problem facing senior citizens, injuries from falling, and we'll talk about how to prevent them.
First, President Obama spoke at the United Nations General Assembly this morning and fired back at Russian President Vladimir Putin's assertion that the United States is not exceptional.
The president said he believes the U.S. is exceptional, and he defended the role America has played in international affairs.
Well, is the U.S. truly exceptional? Should we have a strong role in the conflicts of other countries? Our guest says no. Joining us now is Christopher Preble, Vice President of Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. Christopher, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as we said, President Obama spoke at the UN today, insisted on this idea of American exceptionalism, the idea that the U.S. has a greater responsibility on the world stage than other countries. Now, it's not a new concept of America. Do you think it's still the right position for America today?
Well, I think it really depends on what we mean by exceptional. I certainly think this country is exceptional. I think most Americans feel that way, and it's become sort of a catchphrase to criticize either the president or his critics at different times. But it's really what sort of exceptionalism. You know, the founders of this country envisioned it as a city on a hill, a model to be emulated, one that that would show other countries how to build a good society, build a thriving economy, protect the rights and privileges of its citizens, and expect that that model would inspire others to follow our lead. Somewhere along the line in American history, most people date it to the turn of the 20th century, we became more of a crusader state, that is someone, a country that would go around the world and try to promote this idea, not as a model to be emulated, but actually actively trying to promote it. And I think we see, we see especially after the Iraq and Afghanistan quite a bit of unhappiness, frankly, and dissatisfaction among the American people with trying to do this by force. We've learned that it doesn't work very well. We've learned that it isn't always appreciated. And ultimately, I think we've learned that it isn't really necessary for our security at the end of the day.
Well, seen from one example, it's exceptionalism, as you just defined it originally, being sort of a model, a beacon on the hill, as you said. But seen in other lights, the U.S. can be seen as a watchdog or as a lone wolf. And we do have other bodies of governance now on the world stage. The U.N., for instance, is one of these. And so I guess the question is, how does the U.S., see itself in light of changes in the world and how governance is run these days?
Well, the UN is still a collection of sovereign states. So at the end of the day, the members, each individual member in the UN is prepared or is considers how they will respond based on their own interests, based on the support back at home, based on their own laws. The United States in that respect is no different. We have a system of laws. We have certain rules governing when, for example, the United States deploys forces abroad. And I think we saw, especially in the case of Syria, that in a representative democracy, the people have a voice. The people's representatives last month made quite clear they were not willing to support the use of the force in Syria as the president proposed, and so we're left with something else, that is, other countries being encouraged to do more and step up, with the United States still playing an important role, but not expected to play the only role. And I think that was one of the key lessons to take away from what happened with respect to the Syria case.
Does that mean that Americans, you think, are a little fatigued with the notion of exceptionalism, especially if it's America in there all by itself?
Yes, in the sense that they don't want America to be in there all by ourselves. Certainly, if our core interests are at stake, if our security is threatened, then we are prepared to act unilaterally even. It would be our preference, however, to have allies who are cooperating with us, providing some of the forces or at least supporting us diplomatically and financially along the way. That's, you know, that kind of the next best scenario. But in the case of Syria, you didn't even have that, or it's a very belated and very begrudging. Some of the states in the region were willing to support us, but not in a very meaningful way. And I think that's why the American people were, on top of everything else, on top of their general fatigue, were particularly disinterested in intervening there.
Well, Russia provided us with a kind of plan B, President Obama, I should say, with a plan B in terms of intervening in Syria. But that chapter of the book is not closed by any means. And at the UN, President Obama still said, you know, he hoped that if things didn't go as agreed upon, if Syria didn't surrender the chemical weapons, then we would need to intervene. And I'm wondering what you think about how receptive the UN and other countries will be if that's the case.
Well, it's been a very uneven track record, let's be honest. You know, there have been some uses of force that have been sanctioned by the UN Security Council, most recently against Libya. But I think even the experience in Libya is a bit of a cautionary tale for some member states. You know, that operation was supposed to be designed merely to protect the population in the city of Benghazi, but then it was used as a justification for ultimately overthrowing Muammar Gaddafi, and, you know, he ultimately was killed in the process. And since then, Libya is not exactly a model of stability and security in the region. So I think that given that experience, there's going to be considerable resistance at the UN to sanctioning the use of force as the ultimate punishment. Not that it would be impossible, but that it will just be a harder sell for those who want that kind of a formal sanction by the UN.
Well, in terms of Iran as well, that's another thing that President Obama indicated, that the U.S. is watching closely and, you know, is hopeful about the outcome there. But what do you think will happen in terms of the United States having a responsibility to intervene again should Iran proceed with development of nuclear weapons?
Well, I think that to the extent that the multilateral sanctions, and it really is a broad-based effort, have clearly had an impact on the Iranian economy. They've made it difficult for Iran to use the international banking system. It's clearly had an effect on the people of Iran. It's not surprising that the government there is trying to come up with ways to ease those sanctions. And one way might be to enter into negotiations in exchange for relaxing the sanctions. The problem is that, as I see it, is that here in the United States, here in Washington, there's much less willingness. There's a lot of willingness to talk about increasing sanctions or increasing penalty. There's much less willingness to talk about what could the Iranians do in a concrete way that would result in the United States lessening those sanctions or easing those sanctions. In other words, I haven't heard many people here in Washington talk about what would be accepting yes for an answer. We hear a lot about what the Iranians are not supposed to be doing, but not a lot about what the United States is willing to forego in exchange for the Iranians meeting some of their commitments.
Now, in that opinion piece that ran last week by Vladimir Putin, that, you know, provided the backdrop for the United States to sort of backpedal on the red line against Syria. Mm-hmm. At the end of that piece, Putin had a little paragraph about, you know, the time of American exceptionalism is over and we're all sort of this, I can't remember the exact wording, but it was sort of, we're all citizens of the world.
Right.
One country is not exceptional and another unexceptional, and that this notion, you know, is sort of dated. What did you make of that? And how do you think that was received internationally?
Well, I can't speak to internationally, but it really is pretty absurd. You know, Vladimir Putin is the president of a country that its entire economy is about the size of the Iberian Peninsula, and Russia is literally dying. They have a demographic problem because their life expectancy is shrinking and their population is shrinking. So the notion of Vladimir Putin speaking as though he were the leader of a world power is really quite absurd. It would be a little different if leader of China, for example, or leader of some of the other truly growing and dynamic economies in the world made that charge. But even they would have a very kind of thin argument to make. After all, the United States is still overwhelmingly dominant in terms of its military power, its economic power. Even though we account for just about 5% of the world's population, we still account for about 25% of its wealth and about 45% of its military spending. So, you know, again, we can define exceptionalism lots of different ways. I think we shouldn't narrowly define it as our ability to fight and win wars. I think it's the other things that make us truly exceptional and worth celebrating. I don't take my many lessons from Vladimir Putin, and frankly, I don't think many Americans do. But equally important, I don't think many people elsewhere in the world follow Vladimir Putin's guidance or listen to what Russia has to say these days.
But given the case you just laid out, the reasons that America can be seen as exceptional, I mean, to kind of borrow from the Spider-Man adage, with great power comes great responsibility. I mean, is that true of the United States right now?
It has been, and I think it's something I've written about quite a bit in my life. You know, I think we built up this military power, and it really goes back to the end of World War II and the Cold War. We built up this military power. We were defending countries that were badly broken by war and warfare, shattered physically but also emotionally, psychologically. These countries have since recovered spectacularly. They are wealthy. They are safe. And the time has come for other countries to step forward and to do a bit more, certainly in their own defense, but also to defend common interests. The good news is we have many other allies around the world that do share our interests. What we don't have, unfortunately, is allies with the capabilities and the willingness to use them. And I think that's where we really need to be moving as a country. Precisely because of what I just said, while it's true that we account for about 25% of the world's wealth, that percentage is declining, and we're not going to be able to sustain, at least not indefinitely, being the world's policeman without anyone contributing anything, at least to their own security and ideally to global challenges.
All right, we'll leave it there. Chris, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Chris Preble, Vice President for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute.
Coming up, we'll check the news. Then we're talking about a public health issue, preventing injuries from falling, especially for senior citizens. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
For the elderly, falling down isn't as easy as getting right back up. In fact, a fall can lead to the end of a person's independence.
Our next guest says adult falls are a public health issue. She wants to raise awareness and share some prevention tips. Cheryl Whitkey is with us. She's Executive Director of Safe Communities. That's a Dane County nonprofit dedicated to public health. Cheryl, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So this is one of those issues that doesn't really capture the imagination. It sounds mundane, but it's a really big deal. Can you talk about how big a problem adult falling is?
It is a really big deal. In Wisconsin, it's our number one cause of injury-related hospitalizations and deaths for older adults. And the thing about that that's tragic is that it's largely preventable. There's an awful lot that we can do to prevent older adults from injuring themselves in falls and losing their independence.
It sounds to younger people, it may not sound like that big a deal. You fall down, you get up. But as we get older, I have this to look forward to. Those falls could be more damaging. Talk about some of the, I guess, complications of falls.
Right. Well, if a person fractures their hip, for example, lots of times then they're laid up, and then that puts them at much higher risk for pneumonia and other sorts of related health issues. And it isn't easier. It isn't easy to recover from that as an older person. All of us fall, we trip over rugs, but, when you look at the environment and you look at sort of intrinsic factors that relate to falls, like medications, where maybe we're not metabolizing them in the same way that we did in the past, balance issues, all of those things make older adults more at risk for more serious falls.
Before we get into prevention, I want to talk about some of the costs here. You mentioned the loss of independence, but talk about the money cost. How big a hit is this?
Well, it's huge. One hospitalization related to a fall is $33,000, and that's just an average cost, and that doesn't include all the rehabilitation that goes along with it or the nursing home care that you know, that might follow that. So it's huge. And again, can be spent in better ways, can be prevented.
Well, let's talk about some prevention. You've got a seminar coming up just in a day or two, I think, and we'll let you plug that in a minute. But what kind of things can, first, what can you teach older people to do to avoid falls?
Well, there's four really key factors that relate to falls risk. One is balance. And, you know, it's great to be doing cardiovascular activity, and we need to do that our whole lives. The other thing we want to add as we get older is balance activities. So just cardiovascular activity like walking doesn't necessarily reduce your falls risk. So things like Tai Chi, other balance challenging exercises, even if you're standing at the kitchen counter and you do some leg raises and you know, test your balance, that can be a huge issue. So there's the physical component to that. The other thing is vision screening. They used to say that if you know, you wanted to wait till your cataracts were ripe before they removed them, now the thinking is pretty much that you want to have your cataracts taken care of right away and have your vision checked regularly. Maybe ask your physician about bifocals or not, because you'll notice as you're looking through bifocals that that's quite distorting. If you're trying to climb stairs, those sorts of things. So vision screening is really important. The other huge issue is medication and the interactions of medications, not just prescription medicines, but also over-the-counter things like Tylenol PM and those kinds of things. So making sure that the medications that you're taking aren't interacting in such a way that could make you dizzy. And then finally, the home environment. So, and there's lots of really great programs out there that can help you make your home safe.
One thing I think about is we're in Wisconsin. The ice is treacherous at any age. Is that part of the training there? How, when to not walk on the ice, or safer ways to get around in the winter?
Yeah, as long as people don't limit their activity. I think the one thing that we want to be sure not to do is be so afraid of falling that we don't move, because then that definitely increases your falls risk. The other thing that's interesting is in Wisconsin, we actually have the second highest death rate from falls in the nation. Number one is New Mexico. Minnesota and Michigan, the states around us that have a similar climate, don't have the same kind of falls risks.
What are they doing?
Well, it could be that we're really good at keeping track of this in Wisconsin, and I think that's true. We have really good data surveillance kind of methods. Maybe it's greater gravitational pull. Maybe it's more brandy consumption in Wisconsin. Those are all things that we've jokingly speculated at on our task force. But you know, so we don't seem to think that it's the weather. And actually the falls, if you look at it seasonally, there are more falls actually in April, when people may be getting out for the first time after staying in and may be weakened.
What age should people start thinking about this, either for themselves or for their parents?
Well, really, you want to be thinking about it from young on. You know, I mean, I'm in my early 50s, and I've already noticed a difference in balance that I need to be working on. I think if everybody started younger, we would have fewer issues as people get older. So, but then also we see, you know, particularly in the later 70s, early 80s, that's when a lot more falls happen. And I think a lot of that is because people tend to limit their activity or maybe sort of close in a little bit more. There's lots of great programs out there that can get you out there and get you moving, and that's really helpful.
This sounds cheap compared to the cost you mentioned earlier of hospitalization.
Absolutely. It is. And, you know, and just the mental anguish that goes along with the loss of independence, you can't really quantify that, or the pain with the numbers. And I want to mention that there's a lot of great networks out there that are supporting the kind of programming that older adults can use. We're one coalition here in Dane County. There's great injury prevention, falls prevention coalitions in Kenosha, Green Bay, La Crosse, lots of other communities. If people want to go to the websites of their aging and disabilities resource centers in their communities, they can find out information about programs like the Stepping On program, which is an evidence-based program that's been shown to reduce falls among older adults by 50%. And Tai Chi classes, all those sorts of things are available, and people can plug into them.
When I was poking around online, it seems like this is a big movement. There are seminars, there are events going on in states all over the country. Are we starting to take this seriously as a public health issue?
We are, and there's also really great resources now on the Centers for Disease Control website for clinicians. And I encourage clinicians to look at this. I mean, clearly they're really busy, but there's great tools on this website that can help people identify falls risks and then make proper referrals to physical therapy, those kinds of things.
Kim on Facebook writes, can you address the stubbornness and denial sometimes in older people? My father fell, broke his hip because he refused to use a cane, said he didn't need it. What advice do you have in that situation?
That is huge. That is a big issue that we hear all the time. We do tend to focus on independence in the messaging as opposed to prevent falls and, you know, don't hurt yourself. So I think, I mean, you know your dad better than anybody, and I've got I'm sort of in the same boat with my family. But I think that message of independence, if you know, if you want to be on your own, it's important to take these kinds of steps to do this. And, you know, we're here to help you. And here's some programs. Also, I think especially older adults, they need this message from their clinicians. So having a conversation with your father's doctor maybe about resources and approaches would be a good idea.
Can we wrap up by hearing about your events? You've got something coming up in a couple days on that.
Yeah, and as I mentioned, there's a lot of these kinds of things going on around the country, but around Wisconsin because it is National Falls Prevention Month. September is. So tomorrow we have an event at Covenant Presbyterian Church in Madison called Only Leaves Should Fall in honor of fall and not falling. And basically there'll be about 40 different organizations there screening people for falls risk, including a bunch of students from the UW different health programs like PT and OT. And so people will leave with a prescription of how to prevent falls for themselves.
All right. Cheryl, thank you so much for coming up and talking about this today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Cheryl Whitke. She's Executive Director of Safe Communities. That's a Dane County nonprofit dedicated to public health.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk with the son of late journalist Alexander Coburn about Coburn's last book on American politics, finished just before his death last year.
Plus, film director M. Night Shyamalan joins us to talk about his blueprint for what he says could close the achievement gap in American schools.
And we'll have with us live and in studio the actor John O'Hurley, who's in Wisconsin this week. He's going to be starring as Billy Flynn in the touring Broadway show Chicago.
A lot going on tomorrow. Hope you'll join us here on Central Time on the Ideas Network. Coming up after the news, our guest says 10 virtues of outstanding leaders.
And PBS's Ray Suarez tells us about the rich and influential history of Latinos in America. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.